Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, everyone. It's John here. You can probably tell that it's my voice. It's my podcast. Good, you know it's me here. Anyway, it's Sunday afternoon as I record this. I'm just jumping in before the credits to let you know something, partly because of lockdown, partly for reasons that will be explained momentarily. Our production schedules on Skylines have got a little bit lax of late, which means that our main interviewee this week, my pal Claire, who's been under lockdown in Italy, is at time of writing no longer under lockdown because it's taken us so long to get this episode together that by the time we did, Italy had raised its lockdown. But it's still kind of a fascinating interview, and I thought the best way of dealing with it was to run that and then go back to Claire and drop in a little insert afterwards in which she tells us what the situation is now. Let's get on with the podcast.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, I'm John Elledge, and this is the penultimate episode of Skylines, the Cinemetric podcast. As I record this, who knows what day it is, who knows what day of the week it is, who knows what date it is. It's somewhere around the end of April, but the days have long ago lost all meaning. I think it might be Wednesday, but I'm not even, this isn't like a feint, I'd have to check. It's, you know, lockdown has been going on for some weeks. It's probably going to go on for, if we're very lucky, some weeks more. There was a story this morning about how the British government has said it's not going to have the technology in place to start undoing lockdown until mid-May. And I saw that and thought, that's quite soon, isn't it? That's brilliant. We might be out of here in only 2 or 3 weeks, which is ridiculous. So we've got to a point where another 2 or 3 weeks with everyone shut in their houses feels like really not very long. But we are where we are. We are trying to flatten the curve. On this week's show, we have two interviews. The first of which is very much on this sort of subject, the second of which isn't. The first is speaking to my friend Claire Cox, who is, well, she's in Palermo in Sicily, a city to which she moved earlier this year, mere days before Italy went into a lockdown far tighter than the one we've had in the UK. And apart from the fact that, you know, it doesn't sound like she's having the best time in the world, and therefore it's kind of nice to chat to her and kind of like, you know, give her something to do, really, a little bit. I thought it was an interesting opportunity to hear what a really tight lockdown looks like, because obviously Italy has been far tighter, far more officious about it than we have after having a particularly bad crisis early on. So I'm just kind of curious to know what lockdown Italian style looks like and how it all feels. Then the second half of the show, we're going to do something very different. I'm going to speak to Lai El-Akul, who's a senior associate at POP Architecture, and recently took a position as the chair of the Urban Land Institute's new UK Urban Art Forum. And we're going to chat all about the interaction between the city and public art and how the role that art, particularly public art, plays in placemaking and in shaping our cities. One more bit of housekeeping before we get into all that, though. If you were paying close attention at the start of the show, you may have noticed something. This is the penultimate episode of Skylines. There is only going to be one more after this. All sorts of reasons. We decided to wrap the show up. But the big one is, as you may know, I no longer work for Cinemetric on the New Statesman. I'm still doing some stuff on a sort of part-time freelance basis, but I'm not I'm not a full-time staff member. It was just getting a bit weird, like continuing to have, for me to have my kind of own little podcast as part of the City Metric brand, as part of a site that I don't work for anymore. So we've agreed to sort of wrap up the show. Next week's will be the final episode. I've got a bumper edition planned for that. I'm going to speak to all sorts of people who've been regulars on the show at one point or another about which bits of the show they enjoyed doing, what they'd like us to have done more, and just generally kind of having a sort of, you know, one last victory lap about Skylines and everything we've done here. Because, you know, it's my show. We're wrapping it up on episode 150. I think I get to be self-indulgent for once. So that's what we can do next week. We're also, incidentally, going to hear from some listeners as well. So if you are burning to make a contribution and just tell us in sort of 30 seconds or less what you liked about the show, why you've been listening to it for all these years, then if you wanted to send something to me at johnelledge@gmail.com, then who knows, maybe you'll be included in the last ever Skylines. But that's for next week, though. This week, we do still have two fantastic interviews, so let's go to Italy.
Hello. So I'm dialing in, as it were, from Palermo. So I've moved to Sicily in February. My name's Claire, and I'm working in communications for a small wine business out here in Sicily.
I was told we have to describe you as a wine expert.
A wine expert? Well, let's go with wine expert. That sounds far better.
I can't think of anything better to be an expert in. That sounds great to me.
So, and a great thing to practice as well.
So how long have you been in Palermo?
So I literally moved over in February to start this new position, and had 3 weeks in the office before a short weekend in the UK to come back to complete lockdown. So I was counting earlier, I think we're on day 43.
Blimey. So you'd only been in the country for a couple of weeks when the whole place locked down.
Yeah, so it's a new way to get to know a city, definitely.
I mean, yeah, I imagine you're seeing a huge amount of Palermo from your no doubt lovely apartment.
Very much the two apartment blocks in front of my balcony, and the odd trip to the supermarket has been the cultural summit, really.
So as I understand it, like obviously Italy was the first country in Europe to be seriously hit by COVID-19, and it locked down earlier than the UK. And also the lockdown there is rather tighter than the one here, isn't it? I mean, what does it actually mean in practice?
It's been quite a strange one to live through, and especially, I think, in a situation like this when it's not your own country, but also I've spent a lot of time in my life living and working in Italy, but it's a new, you know, living this far south in Italy is a new experience for me as well. And I think over the last almost 9 weeks, it's the situation has evolved from very much watching what was happening in the north of Italy and regulations becoming stricter in terms of public transport and distancing, to becoming something which at times, and this could just be an experience of a foreigner, but at times it's felt close to being in a police state. So it's had its ups and downs, particularly for that. And I think there have been moments over the last 9 weeks where to go out was to be in fear of being stopped by the police and having your documents checked. Particularly standing out as a foreigner was not something good. So you got to know the streets where the police and the Carabinieri weren't parked, and you just avoid it. And it's been quite an interesting situation to live through for that. I don't think I've ever felt more foreign in another European country.
Wow.
And the great anecdote at the minute, and I think there's been a lot of memes and various things on social media going around for this, is the rate at which they're publishing their new documentation. So at the current point, I think we're on something like version 6 of the form that you're meant to carry around with you and fill out, which is a great idea in practice if you had a printer in your house.
And you can't really go into the office to use their one, presumably, at this point.
No, because you'd need a form to do that.
Ah, okay. Well, that's...
So it's been quite a circular thing. So a good old pencil and rubber, and you just hope not to be stopped and ask the policeman, as I did last week, if you could kindly give me a new copy of the form because I'd run out.
What are you actually allowed to do, and what are you really not meant to do at this point?
So national legislation can at times vary from individual state regulation for smaller Italian states. So what we're finding at the minute is the current situation is that the new decree or legislative act will be passed on the 3rd of May, I believe. And at that stage, it's hoped that we'll move into phase two and we'll be allowed to, or smaller companies should be allowed to go back to work, and there should be greater liberty of being able to go outside without having a clear reason. At the minute, we're still in a state of lockdown in as far as you're allowed to go out for necessity, so shops, pharmacy, food shop, pharmacy, and then with a bizarre addition of bookshops and children's clothes shops being open.
Okay, books are important.
Confused a lot of us.
I'm broadly in favour of books. And how often are you meant to go out? I mean, is it like a thing where they're saying like once a week, or like can you go out whenever you need to, or what's the situation?
Again, I think the problem has been as much confused messaging, different things being said in newspapers by different politicians and on the TV and radio. In theory, as of yesterday, in Sicily alone, you're allowed to go out. It was published, you're allowed to go out for a walk or a run, which I tried, only to find this morning a new piece has been published saying you can only go within 100 metres, 200 metres of your house. And I think that's once a day.
Wow, that's not much of a run, is it?
Not that much. I've seen quite a few neighbours running around the block, which I think I'm probably going to try, just going around in circles. Better than going around circles in my flat, so.
So I think one of the issues back here in the UK has been slightly overzealous enforcement of the rules by certain police forces who are kind of just claiming that the rules are stricter than they are. Is that also a problem in Italy?
I do wonder if that might be the case. It has felt very restrictive, and there are various different police forces in Italy as well, which have different powers, some which are more kind of civil protection services, some which are part of the army, and some which are kind of more national petty crime services. But they all have powers during this moment in time, in theory, to stop you and to fine you. I think the fear really lies in knowing to what extent they really do have these powers, or as you say, whether it's perhaps being slightly overzealous.
And what kind of fine are we talking about here? Like, how much could you be fined?
Well, there have been talks about, especially being people being stopped on beaches and things, of months sentences as well in jail. So we're not merely talking about fines, which I think can range from hundreds of euros to 1,000 euros, but also small term prison sentences. Again, to what extent these are being enforced and where they're being enforced and how much this has been used, I don't know. But these are things that have been stated and in theory powers that police forces have.
And you said that it feels a bit like a police state. Can you sort of unpack that a little bit? What do you mean?
I mean, just interesting things, or not so interesting. Right at the beginning of lockdown, when it was perhaps slightly stricter than we're starting to see now, I got locked out of my house. Fantastic moment to choose. And decided, therefore, I was going to ask the porter if he might have a local number to try and get someone to come and change the locks, basically. And a certain Lorenzo was found. I was given a handwritten school number on a piece of paper, and we tried Lorenzo. And Lorenzo didn't dare come out because he's worried about being stopped by the police. Now, his reasons for fearing stopped by the police actually brought up a new Italian question, which was that he hadn't paid his taxes. So, interestingly enough, part of this lockdown fear, I think, is coming, especially for people that are self-employed, is that these forms and having to declare your purpose and sometimes your tax number for moving from one side of the city to the other are also proving a way to track people if they're paying taxes or not. So Dear Lorenzo wasn't able to come and change my lock, which was unfortunate. So that was a good one.
How did you get it sorted in the end? If Lorenzo wasn't able to help, who did?
I know. Well, my 70-year-old porter, who speaks only Sicilian dialect, and I managed to somehow get a piece of plastic and to kind of pick the lock. It was a fun afternoon.
Oh, wow.
I learned a lot of Sicilian swear words.
And you said it feels a bit difficult being a foreigner in Sicily at the moment. I mean, what do you mean by that?
I think it's a fact that you feel very much you stand out, because a major part of the Sicilian economy is tourism. And so the first 3 weeks that I was here, and I live quite central in Palermo, there's a lot of, you know, foreign voices, a lot of international kind of tour groups, a lot of attraction to all the beautiful historical sites and architectural like places of interest. And so then suddenly you go from that to absolutely nothing. And yeah, I don't think I've seen anyone non-Sicilian on my trips to supermarkets, to pharmacy over the last 9 weeks. So that's felt very weird. And certainly you feel, again, it could also just come from perhaps having spent too long in Rome. But a certain hostility I've felt in supermarkets, clearly not being a local. And when they hear a foreign accent, a certain kind of strange reaction. Now, which is strange because clearly Italy was the first to go into lockdown, but I think it's just, it stands out more that you're not from here at the time when you really are very one of very few who is not from here.
And do you have any sense of how long this is going to last, or are you in the dark about this as everyone?
I'm very much hoping that we'll start to see things lessening over the next couple of weeks. I'm hopeful for the 3rd of May that as of this week, Italian or Sicilian statistics are looking positive with very few or in some areas of Sicily, no new cases of contagion. So we're hoping that if things continue like that, that especially in terms of just being able to go out without an immediate purpose or be able to go and browse the bookshops, because if you go now, you have to be able to state on entry what title of book you need to buy.
Oh, wow.
which I discovered yesterday, and I tried to suggest to the lady, I just wanted to look at the fiction section, she wasn't having any of it. So I think hopefully just freedom like that would make a massive difference, to be honest, just to be able to go out, to go for a walk, to go for a run without feeling that you're watching your back and needing to have a purpose.
It's also worth saying, like, you're in Sicily. You're at the exact opposite end of the country from Lombardy, which is the place of, like, the really bad outbreak, right? I mean, how serious was the pandemic in Sicily before the lockdown?
Well, so in comparison to Lombardy, really not very serious at all. I've had small numbers of cases in different cities in Sicily. I'd say the major cities, Palermo, Catania, have been most hit, Trapani, I think, as well. Then you have small pockets in the countryside, but no, in comparison with the north, we're seeing very little. It's just been quite interesting to see how Italy really has united in this instance, and the regulations which have been decreed in the majority to in reaction to what we've seen in the north have been very well implemented across the country.
Okay, cool. And just last question. I don't know much about Palermo. Obviously, I know it's like the biggest city on Sicily. But if you were allowed out to actually kind of enjoy the place, like what did it have to offer? Why would one go to Palermo?
So it's absolutely beautiful. It's a kind of mix of crumbling beauty and more modern beauty. In Palermo, you're both on the coast, so you've got beautiful beaches, and you've also got historical town centre where you've got it's a city which has seen multiple invasions. It's an island which has been ruled and conquered by many, many peoples over thousands of years, and so as a result you've got everything from Greek remains, Roman remains. And I think possibly the beauty of it is despite being an island which has such a high density of UNESCO sites, they are for the most part, if not badly looked after, very badly publicised. And so it does mean that you can go to these beautiful old Greek theatres or go and see the temples in Agrigento, for example. And whereas in Pompeii, you might be surrounded by thousands of other visitors, you can sometimes on an unlucky afternoon and not in peak tourist season have them to yourself. I'm really hoping when we get out of this, be able to make the most to go and see all of these beautiful places. Also, yeah. The food is fantastic. And of course, the better say that the wine is rather good too.
Yeah, I've not been to Palermo. I have been to Pompeii, and I was surprised to find it's basically in sort of grotty suburbs of Naples. Just imagine this place sort of standing alone in the middle of the countryside.
No, exactly, sort of, you haven't.
Yeah.
Okay. It's all just kind of, you turn a corner and you're there.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking to us, and I hope they'll let you out soon.
Yes, and sending much love back to the UK.
Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
So, as you'll know from listening to my exciting pre-credit sequence, that interview was a couple of weeks ago now. Claire, along with everyone else in Italy, now has her freedom to some extent. So I just thought it'd be nice to kind of get her to tell us what that looks like and how much life has changed. Yeah, here she is speaking on Saturday the 9th of May.
Hello from Palermo. A brief update from the situation here in Italy. I think when I last was speaking to John, we were around late April, around the 21st, and Palermo, Sicily, Italy was still in deep lockdown, and so you couldn't go out for exercise or you had to stay within 100 metres of your house. But here we've now passed into what's being known as Fase 2, so our Phase 2. In many respects, I'd say quite a lot hasn't changed. We have a new form, of course, to fill in when we want to go somewhere. But most importantly, we are now allowed out for our daily exercise, and parks and gardens have reopened. Though, as I did discover to my detriment today, you have to book in advance to go into the parks, and they have a list at the gate. But in happy news, we're seeing little ice cream shops reopen and little restaurants and small businesses are being able to offer services for takeaway. And there are lots of work being carried out on roads and on buildings. So it very much feels that the city's in a nascent phase and everything's being prepared for a big reopening. It looks like next week the shops and museums will be able to open. And we're hoping that on the 1st of June, the third phase really of the Fase 2 will come into play. And I think there'll be greater freedom and things like hairdressers and other smaller shops will also reopen. So it's a period of hope, but also of great uncertainty and confusion, really. It's interesting to see how the Italian culture will work with these new lesser rules, but especially things like seeing how busy today the streets were, especially given the Italian culture of the evening passeggiata, of the evening stroll, how it's going to be to implement social distancing and ensure that we're all kept safe. I hope that everyone will take these rules seriously. And fingers crossed, we'll continue to see good progress here in Italy.
My name is Hala El-Akil. I'm an architect and urban designer with a background in sociology and political science. I work on large-scale projects in the UK, and Europe and the Middle East. I also lead our group at PLP Architecture called PLP Labs that looks at the intersection of people, technology and space. And I lead the Urban Art Forum for the Urban Land Institute in the UK.
Okay, that sounds like an enormously exciting career. Let's unpack that a little bit. Let's start with a big question. What is the Urban Land Institute?
So the Urban Land Institute is a non-profit organization which has a group on all continents, and I'm part of the European and the UK group. It's globally around 45,000 members, and the objective or the mission of the Urban Land Institute is to promote the sustainable use of land. It brings together architects, developers, city planners, local authorities, investors, and so on. The various actors of the built environment, and creates a space for focused discussion on a variety of topics, from infrastructure to cultural placemaking to residential capital markets to technology and so on. There are a number of focus groups, I would call them.
So you lead the Urban Art Forum. Of all the many things we could be doing with our cities, why should we be dedicating part of them to urban art? Why does it matter?
Yes, I wouldn't call it urban art. I would call it culture. And I would expand and use the definition of the GLA, for example, of cultural infrastructure, which incorporates spaces for cultural production and spaces for cultural consumption. We're not talking about a sculpture in a public space only. We're talking about a whole ecosystem, which includes industries, which includes, and now I'm talking about, for example, cultural production in particular. So it includes everything that gets to the final piece. It can go from a recording studio to an artist studio to an atelier where, I don't know, the sets are built and so on. And cultural consumption, it can be that final sculpture, can be a piece in a public space or in a museum or an event. It can go from something that is more permanent to something that is temporary in use. And it is in your question, there's an insinuation on why should this be prioritized. There is a reason why the places we like to return to or to spend time in or to that have a certain level of attractivity have culture as one of their main features. I'm thinking of some neighborhoods of London or Paris or Milan.
Okay, so let's talk about that then. I mean, is there any research to kind of explain why it is that, you know, people are drawn to areas with a lot of culture?
So I think this goes back to the role that culture can play. What's the added added value, or what it brings to a neighborhood? From our research, what we talk about or what we found is, it's about really creating a link between the diversity of user groups and the community living in these spaces. And it's about that connection. So we're talking about the impact of culture on a neighborhood, the impact it can have. That can be social, economic, and environmental. So, for example, social goal can include either reinforcing the identity of a certain area, building a sense of place in an area that may have been neglected or abandoned. Or it can also help bring together different communities or inhabitants of an urban area who otherwise would not really come together. It can help achieve a number of the environmental and sustainability targets that a project or a regeneration scheme may want to achieve. And economically, it can maybe attract a different type of visitors or of tenants in the case of a development, consolidating existing activities, strengthening an identity and bringing people together. So, and this can happen in a variety of ways. And if you want, we can talk about it as well.
We are talking about a number of different forms of value here. There's kind of economic value, but there's also stuff around quality of life. How do you sort of quantify those different things?
So what we found is, and this is a crucial question that you ask, is that for each project, it will be different benchmarks and measurements, depending on what the objective is or what the challenge is, because each site is very different. And some of them, it could be about a shifting perception. And another one, it could be about community building. And another one, it could be about actually generating footfall. So that will vary. So once a vision of success is agreed, there is some time that needs to be spent on establishing what the benchmarks will be. So as a starting point, and what we often forget to do from the research that we've done as built environment professionals, is measuring that baseline before any cultural intervention takes place. And then after that, the measurement will vary. It can go from something that is more qualitative, such as tracking comments from cultural influencer, reference case studies, request, measuring, then measuring footfall, trying to understand the changes to demographic profiles. Business that get that become attracted to the area because of these new activities. So you can design this performance index based on what you are trying to achieve in reality. Some of them can be linked to health and well-being and be tracked via some wearables if it's allowed and if we can build this metric within the wearables. Or, for example, if it's about community building, it starts to be about measuring how often the local community is using some of these spaces and not just visitors.
We're talking in quite sort of like conceptual terms here. Let's drill down a bit. What does the Urban Art Forum actually do? What does a typical project look like?
So the Urban Art Forum is a think tank. So it's about 2 years ago now. We started having a conversation with a number of people, including local authority, developers, local community, creatives, artists, investors, architects, communication and branding, and like cultural experts. And two things became clear. The first one was like the lack of a shared language, which meant that often culture was seen like as a bolt-on. So after going through planning, through all the RIBA stages, through, and having a note to say that there is a cultural element that needs to be included later on, it came as an addition that didn't necessarily feel integrated from the beginning. So what we decided to look at is, when is best to start the conversation? Who should come around the table? And we worked on a guide or a methodology, which goes through six steps, to help these different stakeholders interact and identify cultural possibilities or opportunities for a site. So it talks about the roles and responsibility of each one of them and takes them through the six steps. And there are 10 case studies associated with it. We also meet regularly to explore specific case studies, specific issues, and this can be event-based. And we are looking at a future publication, and we are now narrowing down the theme. It is likely to be around the issue of measurement that you just asked me about in a more detailed form.
Okay, so what are the sort of things that cities should be thinking about in the realm of sort of arts and cultural development, do you think?
What cities or the public sector is looking at, is the preservation of culture as one of its main assets in the context of cities competing with each other. I mean, London has such a big creative ecosystem, and a number of these institutions or artists or cultural groups are being pushed out or priced out or of some of the neighborhoods they have actually contributed to building. So I think the big question for local authorities is to how to protect and preserve and foster these. So how to design policies that protect and foster them, really.
Is there sometimes a tension between who benefits from the presence of arts and culture and who actually has to provide it? In that, like, often we've seen people move to an area because it's a cultural hotspot, but one of the side effects of that is that it pushes up property prices, the culture gets pushed out, everyone complains the area is not what it was. Like, how do we manage that?
I think there are two things. I think the public sector plays a really important role by putting in place mechanisms to preserve that existing ecosystem, but also to encourage the inclusion of additional potential programs. But I also feel like we're in interesting times where developers actually see the value in cultural activation. No one wants to go to a place that doesn't have a soul or that is dry, in which people don't feel they can connect. And cultural placemaking is one of the tools that can be used to make a development more successful, to make the place more attractive and more vibrant. So they do see the interest in preserving these local cultural infrastructure and in adding new ones. Now, there is a tension between prices going up as a result of these coming in. It's what happened in the Marais in Paris, which was a place where no one wanted to go. And then certain communities, including artists, changed and took care of that neighborhood, made it evolve and change, and have been priced out as a result of this. And this is where the public sector needs to, I mean, that's maybe my more interventionist way of looking at things. But I do feel that there is a responsibility from the public sector to create a framework for these to be protected.
I mean, that sounds lovely, speaking as someone who's lived my entire adult life in London, where this is obviously a very live issue. The idea of some kind of mechanism that kind of means that the arts and cultural spaces don't get pushed out by rising property prices sounds wonderful. But how does that work in practice? What does that look like?
So as part of planning application, there are some requirements for a variety of community infrastructure and contributions that go to the improvement of the public realm and so on. And so we have the mechanisms. The idea is to actually make cultural infrastructure part of these in a more obvious way. And I feel like most of these mechanisms are there, and it's about maybe communicating them better to the to developers and so on.
But I mean, developers won't necessarily step up unless kind of like forced to, will they? I mean, communication is one thing, but how do you actually kind of force people to play ball on this?
So I wouldn't say that the developers are necessarily trying to avoid this, because if you look at some of the large schemes in the last 10 years delivered, and there are some really good examples. There are some, like, I'm thinking of King's Cross, I'm thinking of some of Derwent's development and so on. So I wouldn't put a blanket, you know, negative on, you know, like developers trying to avoid providing culture, but it's true that a nudge or an encouragement is welcome.
I mean, as I understand it, the problem is the people who benefit from the presence of culture are quite diffuse, whereas the people who would have to pay for it up front are very concentrated, and it's quite difficult sort of matching those two things up. I mean, how do we make sure that, like, somebody is providing this thing from which they will not be the only one who benefits, if that makes sense?
But I think this goes back to the measurement of the impact discussion, because it's a particular context. I feel that it's less and less something that we as architects have to advocate for. I feel that a number of developers and so on are convinced that about the inclusion of culture in their scheme is something that is essential, and maybe it's the context of the rise of ESG, where they need to report on their impact, and that culture is a way to talk about social impact and measure it and establish benchmarks to be able to report on those. So maybe there is that trend, which is encouraging developers to include culture in a more open way. But as part, there are several moments of a project where culture can be a real tool for everyone.
What are your favourite examples of kind of like culture in cities, whether that's kind of a good piece of public art or cultural production, or, you know, something, point us to something concrete?
There's an initiative which is called the Creative Land Trust, led by a number of organisations, which seeks to provide affordable workspace for artists in London by acquiring property and then owning it in perpetuity, and then renting it out at affordable rates to artists. And one of the person leading that is Candida Gertler, who leading that initiative from the beginning, along with other partners. But she had also launched a previous initiative called Studio Makers, which was also about the provision of affordable workspace for artists in London. And so it's I think this is a really interesting one. Another one, which is also featured in our guide, is Art Night, which is an event that takes place once a year and really brings the neighbourhood alive when it happens.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for your time today, and I hope you enjoy the lockdown.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You've been listening to Skylines, the podcast from City Metric, the New Statesman City site. It was presented and recorded by me, John Anidge, and produced by Nick Hilton. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on iTunes, Acast, or whatever other app you use to get your podcast. And while you're there, why not leave us a nice review to tell other people we're here? It really helps people discover the show, and I'm a megalomaniac, so the more people I can get listening to this, the better, really. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.